We leave the prophetic section of the scripture this afternoon, and we're going to discuss now more of a historical book. As Brother Wayne has alluded to, we're going to be talking about Nehemiah. Nehemiah is an interesting book because Nehemiah introduces us to one of the wonderful governors of the nation of Israel once it returned from the captivity. Israel, of course, had fallen. Jerusalem had fallen in 586 B.C., and as we've learned this afternoon through the decree of Cyrus and then, of course, the preaching of Haggai and Zechariah, the temple in 516 had finally been completed. And then later on, after about 58 years, through which time we have the events of Esther, Ezra comes upon the scene, commissioned by Artaxerxes I, and he is commissioned to not only reform the people, but also reinstitute the religion of that day. It seems very interesting, though, as we look at the period of Ezra, because Ezra not only reforms the religion, but there's some indication in the book of Ezra, chapter 4, that apparently Ezra had made an attempt that failed to rebuild the wall. And we're not sure what happens in the life of Ezra at this point, but apparently, or perhaps, he is at some way discredited, because we don't hear about Ezra again until about 13 or 14 years later, during the reign or during the governorship of Nehemiah, when Nehemiah then is commissioned to go back and finally rebuild the wall, at which time Ezra then steps up to the plate and helps to dedicate the wall and make the people responsible once again to God. Now, the story we pick up this afternoon in the book of Nehemiah occurs primarily in the year of 444 B.C., a very exciting year in the time of the Jewish people, because they had returned from the captivity. They were there trying to reestablish their infrastructure and become the people that they wanted to be. And it's almost been 150 years since Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. The city of Jerusalem is still in ruins, and the year now is 444 B.C. And although Babylon no longer rules the world, and in spite of Cyrus's decree, and in spite of new rulers coming upon the scene, and in spite of even Ezra's reforms, the wall of the city still lies in ruins. The people are disheartened. They're derelict. They're discouraged, and they desperately need a deliverer. It's at that point that we come into contact with our character this afternoon, the character of Nehemiah. Nehemiah means the Lord comforts, and it was certainly through this man that God comforted his people, because Nehemiah was a man who was able to motivate the people to work and to rebuild the crumbling city that had once been the glory of Israel. I think as we look at the book of Nehemiah, I want to just run through it with you this afternoon in kind of an historical way, because unless we know the story of Nehemiah, we really miss the content of that book. And I believe as we break down the story, first of all, we see several things in this story that appeal to us as far as settings. First of all, we open the book in Nehemiah chapter 1 with what I simply might call distress. Remember, Nehemiah is over there in the land of captivity. Nehemiah apparently hears through some people who have come back from Jerusalem about the failed attempt of Ezra to rebuild the wall. He no doubt also knows that the wall is still in ruins as well because of the Babylonian captivity in 586 B.C. And so Nehemiah hears of this attempt to rebuild the wall, and he begins to think very deeply and very sadly about the condition of his city. I believe what we begin to see in Nehemiah is a man of loyalty to his heritage. He was a man who looked to his past and really wanted his people to be at their former glory once again. Nehemiah 1, 3, and 4 says, "And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity of the providence are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So it was, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." The first response that Nehemiah has as he hears of this dilemma his city is in is that he's distressed. And the first thing he does is he approaches not the king, but the King of Kings, the God of heaven. And he begins to cast at God's feet, if you will, the petition of prayer and the condition of repentance, not only for himself, but for his people, because he well remembered and well realized that it was because of sin that the children of Israel had ended up in captivity to begin with. Well, Nehemiah is overcome with grief, and he acknowledges his own sins and the sins
of the people. Now, Nehemiah was a very interesting character, and I think what we learned from Nehemiah is that it is possible to be successful even amidst a land of paganism. Nehemiah was a cupbearer, as he is called, to King Artaxerxes I. Now, that would have been a very responsible position, because what Nehemiah would do day after day is he would bring the beverages in, basically, to the king, and some scholars even say that he would taste them to make sure that they weren't poisoned. And so he had a very responsible position. He had a position that the king had to trust this man. Well, Nehemiah comes in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, just like any other day. This is probably in the spring of 444 B.C. And Nehemiah, the look on his face just isn't quite right. Nehemiah has always been happy up to this point. In fact, Persian kings didn't allow someone in their presence who was unhappy. That just was a no-no. But Nehemiah comes in to do his work, and the king automatically realizes that Nehemiah is going through some sort of mental duress. And the king inquires about that. And I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? Now it's interesting because we see here the diplomacy as well of Nehemiah. He doesn't just waltz into the king and say, king, you know, I'd like to run back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls. Remember, this is the same king that apparently, according to Ezra 4, had halted the rebuilding of Ezra several years earlier. And so notice how diplomatically he approaches this. He approaches this through kind of a pathetic appeal. He approaches it in a way that the king would look favorably by mentioning the tombs and the death and the heritage of his family, which would have struck a chord with this king of Persia. Well, the king not only grants permission, which I think shows us the favorable relationship that this king had with Nehemiah, but the king gets behind Nehemiah's job. He gives him supplies, he gives him timber from the royal forest, and he even gives him an army escort. Now, you know Nehemiah, he doesn't take any of the credit for himself throughout this entire letter, his book. The king granted him, Nehemiah says, to me according to the good hand of my God, which was upon me. Well, that brings us then to the second part of our study, and that is what we might call simply the era of discretion. You know, Nehemiah was a very wise man, and that made him a very good governor. Now, Nehemiah has been commissioned by the king to go back over to Babylon, to Jerusalem, which was going to take several weeks or months to make that trip. And he's going to go over there and he's going to build. But now, Nehemiah doesn't just waltz over there with pomp and circumstance and say, here's what I'm going to do. He is a man of discretion because, first of all, he knows there's going to be opposition to his work. In fact, we're introduced to the two main antagonists that Nehemiah had to face throughout this book in Nehemiah 2, verse 10. It says, when Sanballat, the Horonite, probably from Beth Horon, a little bit northeast of Jerusalem, and Tobiah the Ammonite, official, heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. Now here are these two guys, puppet leaders of the nation of Persia, and they obviously don't want a third party on the scene who might get some of their credit. And so they don't want to see the Jews rebuild the city. They hated the Jews anyway, as has already been pointed out in previous studies. Well, Nehemiah very discreetly begins to set about to see what it's going to take to accomplish this job. He goes out, after being there for 3 days, he goes out by night, and the scripture tells us that he surveys the wall and the city by night. If you'll trace the route that the Nehemiah takes, apparently he only looks at the southern part of the city at this point. But the text says, then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Nehemiah wanted to count the cost first. He wanted to get the assessment first before he approaches the officials of his people. He does, and then he approaches them. Nehemiah approaches, he sets forth his plan, he's very convincing in his presentation, and he convinces them, and here's what they say in Nehemiah 2:18. So they said, let us rise up and build, then they set their hands to do this good work. Here was a man who was a motivator. Here was a man who was going to be a good governor, because he could look at a situation, assess its needs, and then go out and accomplish the task that was before him. You know, the wall is very interesting because as you read Nehemiah, the third chapter, about all the laborers on the wall, Nehemiah makes it an effort for anyone who wants to get involved, basically, who are Jewish. Not only men, but also men and women. In fact, a very interesting verse in Nehemiah 3:12 says, and next to him, as he gives it to the people who were working, was Shalom, the son of Hokeshesh, the half district of Jerusalem. He and his daughters made repairs. And so here's a man here on this occasion that gets his family, his daughters in this case, involved in the building project. Well, you know, Nehemiah realizes that this is not going to be a cakewalk. He realizes that he's got enemies around him. He realizes there's going to be a lot of problems. And so the next section we come across in chapter 4 is what we might call discouragement, defense, and determination. Opposition to the rebuilding begins almost immediately. And it begins in earnest. And it becomes so intense that Nehemiah has to set a defense for his people. He has to divide the people up and make some of them soldiers, as it were. Some of them workers. Some of them had to work with sort of a trowel in one hand to build a wall and a sword in the other hand. And he arms his people and he positions them for both work and also for war. And it's interesting when you read the book how he positions them. He positions them, first of all, by town. In other words, if you're from, let's say, Jericho, and you and your buddies are all from Jericho, he'll place you in one section because you have some camaraderie. And then in other times, he places people by families. He lets them build the wall where it's right in front of their house. And so you see there's an incentive that Nehemiah taps into to get people to work, because when people have a vested interest in a project, they're going to do a little bit better job. And Nehemiah was a wonderful administrator in that respect. Well, again, we are encountering old Sanballat and Tobiah. They are the two major antagonists. And as we'll learn in a few moments, they both have connections within the city. And so that makes Nehemiah's job that much more difficult. But look at the derision that now begins to be thrown at this great building. Nehemiah 4:3. Now, Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, that is Sanballat. And he said, whatever they build, if even a fox or a jackal goes upon it, he will break down their stone wall. Now imagine this. Here's a group of ragtag people coming back from bondage. They're not skilled necessarily in rebuilding the city. It's not been done for a while anyway. And they're up there just, trying to put the bricks together, trying to build. And old Sanballat and Tobiah are sitting back kind of smoking. Even if a fox walks upon the wall, it's going to be so flimsy that it's going to fall. Well, Nehemiah 4:7 also introduces us to some more opposition. It says, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry. Now, what you'll look at as you read the book is a situation where Nehemiah stations people completely around the city, and the picture that you have is that Nehemiah was organizing the labor so that the wall would go up kind of overnight, kind of simultaneously. Everyone worked on his section, and boom, before you know it, the wall was up, kind of overnight. Well, that's what these people begin to see. Sanballat, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, and they're infuriated that that these Jews are actually being able to make some headway. Now, when you begin to look at the map and begin to see where these antagonists are from, you find that the Jews are surrounded. Old Sanballat was from north. He was from Samaria. In fact, he was the governor up there. The Arabs were to the south, the Ammonites to the east, and the Ashdodites to the west. In other words, they were surrounded. And I think the old adage that when the outlook's not too good, we ought to try the uplook, is applicable here. Nehemiah wanted to refocus his people on God, not their situation. Nehemiah 4:14, and I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord. Try the uplook, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. So they do. And the wall just continues to climb right up, brick by brick, stone by stone. But people get tired. Fatigue began to set in. And in chapter 4, you find the people beginning to just become overwhelmed with the task. Then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there's so much rubbish, debris, that we can't go on. The wall, we're not able to build it. Well, Nehemiah gets in there, he encourages them, he revamps their thinking, and through the skill and encouragement of this great governor, this great administrator, they build the wall. Nehemiah chapter 4 verse 6 says, so we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now why did they have a mind to work? Well, they had a mind to work because, first of all, they had a great leader. They had a great administrator. And they had a man who realized that there was a vision out there that he could inspire and instill within his fellow man. That was to rebuild the city. But you know, like any project, there's going to be distractions that come along as well. You know, wouldn't it be wonderful in our life if we could just set our mind to a particular task and just stay at that task and just keep working on that one thing, focal, tunnel vision, one-track mind until that task was done. But you know, life's not that way. You know, when I was working on this preacher study, and I know the other preachers, you know, I would have liked to have sat down and just studied Nehemiah until Nehemiah was done. But people kept getting sick and going to the hospital, and people kept calling me on the phone for counseling for other issues, or I kept having to, you know, work up other sermons. You see, there's distractions. That's what Nehemiah faced. You know, Nehemiah was in the midst of this great big building project, and all of a sudden he discovers that there is not only external problems. Sanballat and Tobiah are not only having a heyday, but there's problems and abuses internally as well. Here are some of the abuses. Very interesting. There had begun to develop in the city of Jerusalem already at this point by these exiles who were returning what we might call a hierarchy of social status. The rich were oppressing the poor. The rich Jews were oppressing the poor Jews. Many of these Jews, obviously coming back from captivity, were already in dire straits financially, especially the farmers who were trying to now begin to eke out a living by the land. They were poverty-stricken. They also had large families, which made supporting those families very difficult. And so they had it hard. Others were being forced to mortgage their land to their fellow rich Jewish brothers to pay or to buy their grain and to buy other supplies. Others were being forced to borrow money to pay the royal tax. And still others were even selling their children to other Jews into what we might call debtor servitude. And so this rich class of nobles was oppressing the poorer class of Jews who were helping with the wall and again trying to reestablish their lives back in the homeland. But when Nehemiah figures this out, he is absolutely indignant. He is angry beyond anger. It's people over projects for Nehemiah. In fact, in this chapter, you don't find anything about the wall. Nehemiah apparently takes a hiatus and focuses on the people because he realizes, as Doug pointed out, that the wealth of a nation is the people. And so if he doesn't correct the abuses internally, it doesn't matter if the wall goes up because the city's going to collapse from its own weight. Well, notice this picturesque way. You know, the Jews were always very picturesque in their presenting the truth. You know, we noted from some of the prophets how they would act out parables. Well, that's what Nehemiah does. It says in chapter 5, verse 13, then I shook out the folds of my garment and said, so may God shake out every man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and empty. And all the assembly said, amen, and praise the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. So Nehemiah corrects these abuses. And during this period of time, by the way, too, as governor, he would have had the right, technically, to require people to support his livelihood, but he didn't. He, in fact, that he even fed others from his table at his own expense. So Nehemiah sets a great example here. Well, the next segment, found in chapter 6, is what we might call the segment of defamation. Nehemiah has been successful up to this point. Nehemiah has not paid attention to Sanballat or to Tobiah or Gershom or the other guys who are after him. He's corrected the internal abuses, and it's obvious that Nehemiah is going, apparently, to be successful with this building project. So, once again, enter on the scene Sanballat, Tobiah, and Gershom the Arab. And they come, and they want to discourage Nehemiah, but they first of all want to make a deal with Nehemiah. They think, you know, if we can't beat Nehemiah, then let's make a deal with him. Here's what they propose in Nehemiah 6:2. Sanballat and Geshem said to me, came to me, saying, come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me harm. Now, Ono was apparently a little segment up there by Samaria, kind of a no man's land, probably neutral territory, they thought.
They were trying to apparently lure him from the safety of the city, and obviously they were going to kill him. Well, Nehemiah says, you want to meet me on Ono? Oh no, we won't do that at all. I have no intent of leaving my job. I've got a better work, Nehemiah 6:3. So I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? Nehemiah was a man of single vision. There was a job to be done, and he was not willing to let that job go and meet with enemies or be distracted or be defamed while his people still had needs. Well, when Geshem and Sanballat, Tobiah realize that they're not going to be successful, what they do is they send out what is called an open letter. It's a letter that everyone can read. It was really a defamation type of certificate that talked about how bad Nehemiah was. And what they do is they plan, accuse him rather, of building the city so that he can make himself not governor, but king, and create a revolt. So they accuse old Nehemiah of really, you know, building the city for himself and trying to be the big shot, trying to make himself king. And they try to defame him. They try to make his name mud. But Nehemiah doesn't have anything to do with that. In fact, you know, I really like what the NIV says in this verse. It's kind of humorous. It says, I sent them this reply. Nothing like this is what you were saying is happening. You were just making it up out of your head. And that's sort of a, you know, a good modern way of saying, you know, this is just a bunch of hot air you guys are blowing around. Well, it's at this point that they also, and I'll leave the story to your own reading, but they also hire a false prophet to try to get Nehemiah to leave the work and to flee to the temple and to leave the job behind, scare him into hiding, but that doesn't work as well. Well, we finally come then in 444 BC to October the 2nd, as best we can determine. It's the fall of the year. These people have labored probably through the months of August and September, which, by the way, in Israel are very hot. And so it would have been a very grueling task that all these families were laboring under. But they come down to what we might call D-Day, October the 2nd, 444 B.C. It's the sixth month, month Elul, in the civil calendar. And the wall is finally completed. Nehemiah 6:15 says, so the wall was completed on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Now this was a colossal task. Jerusalem was a huge city by standards of what they had to do as far as work was concerned. And now they complete this in 52 days. So we begin to see that Nehemiah was a wonderful organizer, wonderful motivator, because the people accomplished their tasks. And in Nehemiah 6:16, it says, when our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. You know, that verse reminds me of what the people of Jericho and other cities in Canaan, remember, had thought when Israel finally had come across the Jordan River. You know, all of the wonderful mites that God had done in the wilderness and even back in Egypt began to catch up with them as far as the idea of rumors, you know, and the people knew that this was something that was going on here. It was not of a pagan God, but it was of a true God. The Lord was responsible for this. Now you'll notice that there's no dedication of the walls, even though the walls are completed up here. That happens later. Because Nehemiah knows that even though the walls are done, there has to be some more work. They have to rebuild the infrastructure of the city. You can't have an empty city and it really be much. You've got to fill up the city. The captives then are going to be part of the development of the city in chapter 7 through really the end of the book, or toward the end of the book in chapter 12. These chapters give a lot of lists of genealogies and priests that we won't go into today at all. But the captives are returning. The people, first of all, are registered. Nehemiah sets out some plans on what we might call urban development and planning. He registers the people. And then there's what we might simply call the Watergate breakout. Nehemiah 8:3 and 9:3 says that Ezra now steps back into the scene after an absence of probably 12, 13, 14 years. And it says, Ezra read the law aloud from daybreak till noon as he faced the square before the water gate in the presence of the men, women, and others who could understand. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law, and they confessed and worshiped the Lord their God. So what we begin to see is not only a rebirth of the city, but a spiritual revival and rebirth
of the internal hearts and the souls and the spirits of the people as well. Now, as best we can figure out, this occurs somewhere around New Year's Day. In fact, there's a New Year's Day celebration, which is the first of Tishri on the civil calendar. The Feast of Trumpets is celebrated. Later on, Sukkot, or the Feast of Booths, is celebrated. It's a great festive time. And then 2 days after the Feast of Booths is finished, they have a period of mourning and confession of sins and fasting that is very much like what we might call today the Day of Atonement, although it wasn't on the same date. And they begin to confess and rededicate their lives to God. And at that point, 84 officials are listed as standing up and making a covenant with God. In other words, they say, listen, this is a wonderful thing Nehemiah has done. We're going to stand up and we're going to make for sure that we not only have a city that looks good from the outside, but that is reformed on the inside as well. And you know, of course, that's what we're to be doing in our spiritual lives. We're not only to look the look, but we're to walk the walk. We're to have an internal reformation as well. Well, Nehemiah goes on. He repopulates the city. 1 out of every 10 families are moved back into the city. He also does some work, as you'll read there, on the outside villages around Jerusalem in developing the infrastructure. And then now that the city is filled with people, it's time to go back to the wall and dedicate the wall. This has been a wonderful task that has been accomplished in a very short time, a wonderful feat. And so now it's time to dedicate this wall to the glory of God. The wall is dedicated in chapter 12 and 13 with great celebration and joy. And there's this huge procession. It's very interesting to read. It's the walking of the walls. Nehemiah assembles two choirs, two groups, really, two parades. He's in one and Ezra's in the other. And they go up on the wall. Now, you know, when we think of the wall, I think we also need to keep this in mind when we're thinking about this great task that these common people accomplished. You know, a wall wasn't just a little stone fence. It was something that was many feet high, several feet wide, wide enough at times even for chariots to ride on top, although we're not sure in this case how wide it was, but it was obviously wide enough to have processions, crowds of people walking on top the wall. A wonderful thing. So what they do is they take these two groups up. Ezra takes one, Nehemiah takes the other, and they circle the walls, blowing their horns and celebrating. Then they join back together. They go back into the temple area, and there then they have some more reforms. And one of these reforms is that they appoint responsibilities to the temple people who work there, the priests, Levites, so on and so forth. They also make some more rulings about Ammonites and Moabites. Of course, you remember who Tobiah was. He was an Ammonite. But Ammonites and Moabites then are excluded from the congregation. And so there again is more reforms during this period of celebration. Well, as we come now to the 13th and final chapter of Nehemiah, Nehemiah has been governor now for about 12 years. And his first stint as governor is just about to run out. And it's at this point that Nehemiah is either recalled or somehow goes back to Artaxerxes, and he's going to have his governorship recommissioned. And so there's been about a 12-year period where Nehemiah is working with the people. Now, obviously, the book of Nehemiah primarily focuses on 1 year, 444 B.C. But Nehemiah is governor for 12 years, then he goes back to have that governorship renewed. Well, it's during that absence, it's during that departure that all kinds of abuses begin to spring up. And as we noticed a few minutes ago in Brother Wayne's study, it may very well be that Malachi, at this point in time, has to step up to the plate and begin to try to correct some of the abuses that begin to crop up during this period of time. Let me throw this up real quick. This is just something I'll just throw up here just for a second. When you compare the similar themes of Nehemiah and Malachi, you'll see a lot of the same things going on, which again leads us to believe that it may have been during this period of time that Malachi has his ministry. Sins that are opposed, such as priestly corruption, corruption with the tithing and with the sacrifice, foreign marriages, other abuses with the tithe, Sabbath violations, and all of those find their commonality in both the book of Malachi and the book of Nehemiah. Well, Nehemiah returns probably around 428. He's been gone probably only
as best we can determine, maybe a year, year and a half, at the most maybe 2 years, and the people, some of these same officials, 84 officials who have, you know, promised to be so stalwart in their, who had constantly sent letters back and forth during this time that Nehemiah was rebuilding the wall, kind of telling Tobiah what was going on. Well, it's during Nehemiah's absence that old Tobiah, through the high priest's blessing, had taken up residence in the temple itself. He just simply moved in. Well, Nehemiah has to throw the baggage out. He has to throw him out and cleanse the temple once again. Well, old Sanballat has also sort of weaseled his way into the city. Sanballat's daughter, during this period of time apparently, had married Eliashib, which was the high priest's, or had married Elisha's grandson, rather. Elisha was the high priest. And so Nehemiah simply, he expels the newlyweds from the city, it would seem. He says, newlywed, great, but you're not living in my city. He kicks them out too. Also, they weren't paying the preachers. The preachers were having to go get other jobs. The Levites were not being supported. They were being forced to seek secular employment. Nehemiah comes back and says, you need to be supporting these guys. That's what the law requires. And then also, there was something very fishy going on the Sabbath while Nehemiah was gone. They were buying and selling, and people from Tyre up there in the north were bringing their stinking fish down, and they were bringing it into the Sabbath, part of the city on the Sabbath, and they were simply having a fish market on the Sabbath as well as other markets. And Nehemiah has to cleanse all of that as well. And then finally, one of the things that Nehemiah has to do is he has to take care of marriages. He has to deal with what we might call the case of a match not made in heaven. You know, one of the problems that people of God always had and still have today is that they want to marry pagans. They want to marry people outside the Lord. And Nehemiah wants no part of this. Just like Malachi had to correct these abuses, Nehemiah also, just like Ezra did, Nehemiah also corrects this. Look at the way he does this. Very graphic in Nehemiah 13:23. Moreover, in those days, I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. After their children spoke the language of Ashdod and the language of one of the other peoples and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. I rebuked them and called down curses on them. I beat some of the men and pulled out their hair. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, you are not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons for yourselves. Old Nehemiah, he gets pretty violent, really. He gets pretty physical with these pagans who are not pagans, but these Jews who were married, these pagans. And so then, that's where the story of Nehemiah ends. Nehemiah was a man who had a vision. He was a man who was a man of prayer. That's some 9 prayers in this book are attributed to Nehemiah. He was a man who had constant faith in God, who tried the outlook, even when the outlook was terrible. He was a good motivator, and he was a man who ultimately not only rebuilt the outside of Jerusalem, but tried to rebuild the hearts of the people of the city as well.